Hello and welcome to White Line Wireless's continuing coverage of the Australian Imperial Force 11 tour. We are getting to the end of our English portion of the tour, and to join me in these last few weeks in England, it is Russ Degnan. Hey Russ, how you going?
Hi Ant.
And so Russ, been the boys have been touring around since last we were talking about them, and had a trip up to Scotland, and now they've just sort of played their few most important games. So had a game against, two games against South of England, which were, you know, variable. Two different sides, two different South sides. Won one, lost one. But today it's C.I. Thornton's 11. And this is as close as we get to Australia via England on this test, on this tour, sorry. And then we've got a game against Mitcham, which we'll get to at the end. And I believe we might have some listeners from the Mitcham Cricket Club, so a big hello to all of you there, and I hope you're enjoying your 100th anniversary celebrations of this game as well. Okay, so C.I. Thornton's 11 being played at North Marine Road in Scarborough. So this is at the Scarborough Festival, which is, that's been going. I've been reading papers from the 1850s the last couple of weeks, so Scarborough was going in the 1850s and was a big week then, so they used to do this with their cricket festivals. So there was Canterbury and Scarborough and the other really Clifton as well. So they had these. Okay, so we'll jump into Cal Corner's diary. The official title of the first match this week was Mr. C.I. Thornton's 11 versus the Australian Imperial Force. This, however, is too big a mouthful, so we need to call it an England 11 versus the Australians. However, it is arguable that this title is not necessary for only ease of telling alone, but that it is a fair assessment of the game. After all, the 1912 Australians were missing the Big Six and could still rightfully claim their places in Australian 11. Hobbs, Douglas, Spooner, Rhodes, Hurst, Hitch sure reads like a test team. If you have a look at this side, like, you've got Hobbs, Douglas, Spooner, Rhodes, Hurst, Hitch, like, they're some of the most famous names in all of cricket history. So, quite a real solid side that they had. So, had Twining as well. Dolphin, he could play. They had Falcon and Dolphin. So, they've got all their bases covered.
Very much a pre-war side, though, but perhaps.
True. Yep.
Somewhat getting on, a few of the players.
Rhodes. Yeah.
And Rhodes was sort of getting on for most of his career, I think. But
yeah. So how old is... So Rhodes is born in 77, so that makes him 42. Yeah, so he's 42 at this point. And I think Hobbs wouldn't be much younger, would he? No. Yeah, so Hobbs is 37. So, yeah, definitely not what they would have been in 1912. But one of the big things about this tour is, as they've gone around to each county, is playing kids, playing old guys, playing mixers. And there has been a few points where a few places have said there are no kids. And because it's not just that you've lost the... it's not just that you've lost the 4 years of 5 years of county. It's also you've lost all of that feeder sort of stuff. So you've still had the public schools going on. Which is why the Wisden Cricketers of the Year for 1918 are all schoolboys. They were the best schoolboys. And so that's still been going on, but that's Eton, Harrow. You know, it's not a massive amount of schools. And so, but none of the county system was there, so none of the Colts teams were running. So outside of the public school system, there wasn't a lot of opportunity for juniors to be playing. So I think that's really, really strangled them.
There's a very good side coming, as we know, in the late 20s for England, and they've not had to fight in the war.
Yeah.
But there's this gap.
There is. I think And that's one of the things I've been trying to sort of get through in this podcast, but not just tell people, but this is sort of the journey of discovery that I've been on, has been, you know, that period of the 1920s is Australia just absolutely dominates. And I think a lot of it has to do, A, with how much more England lost. You know, they just, it's something like, it's 250 first-class cricketers compared to Australia's 20. So much more considerable. Loss of stocks in the game. But also this particular Australian team, this AIF team, becomes the nucleus of the Australian Test team going forward. And I think there's some attitudes in Collins's leadership that we've seen. So this transition from Callaway to Collins. And, you know, you hear guys later in the 30s and 40s mentioning that it all goes back to Collins and Collins's leadership. And he was very much a leader who was first amongst equals, and he was very interested. He would be, you know, today what he was doing a lot, you'd be calling sports psychology. You know, he's very interested in mental well-being of the players and how they reacted to big events and those kind of things. So he was very ahead of his time in a lot of ways, and also set a lot of the tropes, I guess, for Australian captains that continue down through the years. Although you have that big gap with Bradman, which is sort of goes back to that Callaway style of captaincy of autocracy and isolation. So yeah, there is a very powerful English team coming, but they are not apparent yet. So we'll jump back over to Cow Corner, see what else is going on. Although beaten in this match, the victory carries no disgrace to our soldier cricketers, as the team which they met was, to all intents and purposes, an England 11. The Scarborough Festival, which is usually held at the end of the cricket season, has by this time become historic because so many of England's great cricketers take part in the cricket week. The Australian teams, which in normal times have played in the second match of the week, have recognised that whatever may have been their fate in the test matches, they were almost certain to be up against a stiff proposition at Scarborough. So I think that's worth noting. It probably wouldn't have been a test match this second game at Scarborough. It probably would have been against another one. But this was a regular match, the second match at Scarborough, when Australia was there, was Australia versus. And I think often Thornton's 11 or one of those, which is intended to be a very strong side. I guess a whole lot of this paragraph has all been about establishing that idea that in the minds of a lot of people, this is not the Australian Imperial Force 11, this is the Australians. So, yeah. All right, back to Cow Corner.
Well, it's probably emphasised too by the fact that the last Australian side they'd seen was missing quite a few players. So as far as anyone could remember, this is about as good as Australia normally plays.
And arguably this is better than the 1912 side. You know, so they're not as good as Australia's test side could be at that in 1919, but it is arguably, you know, as good as a side that was missing Armstrong, Trumper, Hill.
Yeah, that's right. So as good as a side they've seen in a decade.
Yeah, it would be, because the one before that is 09, and I think the 09 side was okay. But yeah, and you know, they probably wouldn't have seen a bowler like Gregory come out of Australia since Spoff. You know, he was fearsome. It is interesting. It comes up again and again. He is a level above anything that's happening in England. So it's I guess it's kind of like how Jofra Archer's sort of come out of nowhere in 2019, and all of a sudden England have a 145k an hour bowler, which is 10k quicker than what normally comes out of England. So it'd almost be like that, but even more so, because there's probably guys bowling 10k slower than him, but most people would have been 20, 30k slower than him. So as he was going and touring around, especially with all the older guys, but yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you look at the future of cricket. There's always talk in the newspapers around the Bodyline era of, oh, yeah, but you remember when Gregory
Yeah.
Came and messed us up. And then there was post-talk after the, when Miller and Linwell were doing it to England, of, well, you remember Bodyline. So there's they were begetting each other in terms of pace and fire.
Yeah, yeah.
Some had them and some didn't. And this is, in some senses, I think maybe the first example, at least in the, I would say, modern era, that period that we know cricket much better, where that he was the player that was fire and brimstone against English batting, that they said, we need something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, there was Spoff, who, the demon, was the most fire, yes. Fire and brimstone. But yeah. But
in that modern...
But, yeah. Yeah, but he was, you know, quite gone by then. And it's right, he's a long line of a Australian pace bowling. But remember, he's an all-rounder as well. So, you know, it's take... I don't know, take who'd be a contemporary batsman to Gregory today out of the Australian side.
It's an interesting question because the current Australian side has very good bowlers who can bat actually reasonably quite well.
Well, I think this would be more like taking the bowling of Stark and giving it to the batting of Khawaja.
Mm-hmm.
Like his
But his average probably isn't substantially above Cummins.
No, probably not. We can, yeah, we have access to those kind of statistics. We can look them
different
up.
Different errors, of course.
Yeah, you can't compare. So, what's his test? Test batting average of 37.
I know it's substantially above that. It was much higher than I thought.
37 is significant. That's more like a 50 today. Yeah, so more like a 45 today. So, you know, like no one averages over 50 on the tour. The highest average of this tour was Callaway on 56 after six games. But I think Gregory averaged about 42 and he was the second highest. But yeah, your averages are much lower before you start covering wickets. So yeah, bowling average of 31. So maybe not quite as good a bowler, but had that fearsome pace.
But in many ways, that makes him a lot like Stokes, you think.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, probably. Yeah, probably comparable. Yeah, comparable to Stokes. Like, can rip through. You know, he had in 24 test matches, he had 4 or 5 wicket hauls. So, you know, he could rip through. But, and an economy rate of 2.84, which is actually pretty high for. Yeah, you know, that's at the higher end of the 1920s. But so back to Cow Corner, who is telling us about Scarborough Cricket Festival. Grace, Ranjitsinghe, McLaren, Haywood, Stoddart, Hobbs, Richardson, Barnes have all been participants at one time or another. Mr. C.I. Thornton collected a very representative England team, and in name, the game is a test match. And that very wordy little sentence is actually correct. I've stumbled over that a number of times now, even when I was writing it. The Australians had expressed a desire that this match should be regarded as a test match. Certainly, the strength of both 11s would justify it being regarded as such. So, this is about the time when... they're trying to organise the next Ashes. England have said, look, we can't come out this summer. Because at one point it was looking like the English were going to follow the Australians home, essentially. And they're like, well, we can't do it this summer. We need at least another season. The Australians were going to go out the next year and then they didn't because it was England's turn. And they were sort of like, we paid you back with this AIF tour. It is actually your turn to come. You need to come, and so yeah, the 2021, it takes till 2021 to get it through, but this match was very much, because there'd been this anxiety all series about, very much before it started, and over the summer, but very much before it started, whether they were thinking about doing test matches, there was both nations thought they were going to be no good and going to get thrashed, and so no one was willing to put a representative team up. Because they were like, we just don't know. So this game especially is very much pitting the two teams, best in England, the best in Australia that are still left in England. It's very much about putting the two teams against each other and going, okay, how close are we to being able to play an England-Australia game? So, because, you know, the AIF 11 had gone out and thrashed this CI Thornton's 11, then it probably would have been a couple of more years before we got an England. They would have wanted two or three county seasons first.
It's a different era as well in the sense of organising test matches, because all the pre-war tours were organised essentially by the players, at least on the Australian side.
No, so that's up till... So 19th, well, that is the reason why the Big Six don't go.
Because, that's right, but except for that one tour, it's just mostly more or less playing 11s. There's been an Australian Cricket Board attempted to take control and then failed. And then
yeah, so this is going to be a big part of the book that I'm writing. So I'll go into this in more detail in a future medium. But yeah, that sort of is kicking around. Even earlier than that. That is a struggle that's ongoing, which you can really even trace back to 1860s with the first attempt at the VCA, the Victorian Cricket Association. So it is, yeah, it's 1912 is the big fall apart, but administrators trying to take the game off the players is something that's about 40 years old at this point. It is a constant back and forth. But the players...
This is, in some senses, the first time when they probably had full control. As in, at this point in time, the players didn't really have a lot of control over what was happening.
Well, the military are organising this.
That's
one.
Right. But the future tours are...
Yep.
You guys don't have a say anymore.
Yeah.
And so it's a different type of...
Yeah, absolutely.
...organisational principle, I think,
in
terms of those future tours.
So the tension between the players and the administrators is something that builds over time. But you are right that the next time that a tour happens, it is 100% border control. And... forever, basically, and well until Packer. That's the first time you have a readjustment of that. So, you know, we're about to go, and so you have Australian border control. A couple of years of that, then you have Bradman. Bradman becomes team dictator, ends up becoming plays that role within Australian cricket then all the way through to the 70s. So, you know, that's actually one of the reasons why I'm focusing on this tour. Not one of the reasons I picked it, because I've come to this later, that I've realised that this particular turning point is this tour, this change from player control to administrator control. It really is, I think, symbolic when Birdwood sort of kicks Callaway out. That to me is almost the symbolic moment, even though Callaway is the administration man. When Birdwood sort of kicks Callaway out and puts it back in control of the players, that's almost like it's the last gasp of player control. But after that, never again is there sort of a captain in charge like there was beforehand. Yeah, yeah. All right, back to Cow Corner telling us about Thornton's 11. So there are about 6,000 spectators on days 1 and 2. On day 3, doubtless a good many holiday makers found the attraction of the St. Ledger irresistible. So St. Ledger is a horse race. Financially, as well as in a cricket sense, the revived festival has been a big success, despite the broken weather of early days. The play was followed with as much keenness and enjoyment as if an Australian test team and a fully representative England side were in opposition, as they usually are at the festivals in the years of Australian visits. Despite the 4 losses which the AIF team has had to submit to, the tour on the whole has been a wonderful success from every standpoint, and it can be safely said that it has, if anything, added to the prestige of Australia in the cricket world. So, yeah, there is now a sense that cricket's back. Very much so. The financial anxiety of the start of the season is gone. This team has toured around. And it's not that these are the biggest matches in every county. The Australian games aren't the biggest matches. It's not as big as Kent, Yorkshire, for example. For a lot of counties, the Yorkshire game is the big one. But some counties, it is by far their biggest game of the season. But for all of the counties, it is one of. And because essentially, the funding arrangements were, if you want the money counter, you can have it all. Otherwise, we'll split it 50-50 and we'll chuck some back into the comforts fund. But the counties were allowed to keep 100% of the profits if they felt they needed it. And so, not all the clubs. A lot of the clubs were really struggling financially by 1919, and this has gone around and given everyone an extra load of cash. So yeah, a game that they wouldn't have had. And you know, we are talking here that one successful game can be the difference between a profit season and a loss season. Like, that is the figures that you're talking. You know, profits, losses and profits for a county cricket club at this stage are somewhere between the £100,000 mark. You can probably get £300-400 out of a big game. So, yeah, so it can be the difference for a lot of teams in going forward. So financially, it's had that success, but it's not just the money as well. It is the numbers that have been drawn, and that it has shown that there is an appetite all around England to see Australians play cricket. Now, if they'd had a big county season, then the story at the end of 1919 would have been, okay, cricket's back. And then it would have been a few years of, well, because a lot of people didn't really want to go back to international cricket. They were like, you know, the county stuff is that's what's important. You know, international cricket's a Mickey Mouse sideshow. But now we know that, yeah, so not only have they given all this money, but the crowds have come. We know that it's going to be financial success the next time Australia comes. And I think that's really important in terms of kicking touring off again, because it's the last four or five Ashes series before the war lost money. It had been very rare for there to be a profit-making Ashes series. And this was, so the 1900s, even though the players were very much in control still, they were getting guaranteed by the MCG. You know, so the MCC, the Melbourne Cricket Club, or various other cricket clubs. You know, each of the state boards would all sort of back a certain amount. So they would lose money. Especially if an England team. So yeah, the way Marylebone guarantees when Australia goes there, Melbourne guarantees when England goes to Australia. So if England come to Australia and make a loss, the MCG suffers, and vice versa. And so, there are some talks in the financials, if you read the minute books at Lords, there is some back and forth in that couple of years before the war as to, we can't keep doing this. You know, it cost Lords £2,000 the last time we sent a team out and almost bankrupted Lords, so we can't keep doing it.
And it's an interesting inflection point in the way cricket went from here, because international cricket just became more and more important.
Yeah.
From this, and there's if you look through old wisdoms, every single year there's almost a cricket might collapse, county cricket might collapse. That there's always this worry about finances.
I have this joke a lot, right? The most common thread in cricket journalism is cricket is over. And I found this, the earliest I found this article in 1848. Right, so it's at the end of cricket. Cricket is over, 1848, which in 1848 actually was a chance it was going to be over. You know, before the professional teams start touring around, it is the London game more than anything. Nobody else in England really plays it. And yeah, so it's, but yeah, it's the...
But there was all this anxiety about county cricket, and yeah, the county teams went down this path of, they've got their big games and they've got Australian games, and they kind of keep them afloat. That's kind of the point that I ended up at by the kind of 50s, 60s. And it's interesting to see that there was that chance that, well, maybe that wouldn't have been how they tried. Maybe they needed to make a different type of cricket. Maybe we would have seen more one-day T20 style cricket in the county game earlier, because that would have been what kept them afloat if international cricket wasn't the saviour it ended up being. But obviously this was successful, and then therefore it's taken them down this path of, actually, we can make a success of this. Well, subsidising the rest of our cricket from these international matches.
Yeah, as opposed to the other way around, which is what it had been before the war, was, you know, your local cricket supported international cricket. Even on the tours that did make money, that was the players making money. And then, you know, it had reached a point where the players would make money and the clubs would lose. And then it does. This really does begin. Because the 2021 tour is quite profitable and big in Australia, probably because, you know, that's the first whitewash, so I imagine that, you know, that draws crowds in. And then over the 20s, the rivalry starts building up. Australia had the domination so much from 20, and then by 28, you know, England's sort of back, and then you get come through to 32 and you've got the, you know, the biggest Ashes series of, in history, really. Yeah, I think there's, yeah, it is an interesting inflection point for many reasons. And one of the things I'm writing in my book is I'm actually going right back. I figured I actually can't tell this story without telling you about what happened in 1848. So I'm going right back, but I won't go much forward. Because I've read a lot of the other cricket histories from the 19th century. Pay a little bit too much attention to cricket, let's put it that way. And I think there's a lot of cultural stuff going on that makes this all make a lot more sense. You know, understanding the oligarchical and patriarchal, paternalistic nature of Lords and the MCC and cricket in general is really, you really need to know how that is. You know, it's a mid 19th century sort of institution that's still it's irrelevant and that kind of thing, but it sticks around and it really helps you understand all these different attitudes in cricket and the, you know, the conservatism and the traditions in it and things like that. But yeah, I think it is there's a lot of things, because we normally sort of took, you know, before and after being like 1890. That's really common. You know, once you get that, so you get 1890 through to 1910, it's what we call the, you know, the golden age of Test cricket. Yeah, there is a point where afterwards everything is different, and it kind of is this point for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, and it's the amateur versus professional thing within England as well.
Yep.
Which the golden age was like that golden age of amateur cricket, essentially, in a lot of ways. And then it goes into 40 years of decline and then non-existence beyond the early 60s.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's...
And this is the point at which that decline had kicked off, in large parts because of the war, but not only because of the war.
Yeah, well, and that's actually... So that's like one of the other stories that I want to feed into this is the amateur professional divide, which, you know, that it's great. I've been reading all these primary sources. I've read like every week of English cricket from 1848 to 1870 now, and yeah, seeing how that those professional touring 11s come about, and how it's interesting. I've come across this bit, and it's sort of there's one of the so George Parr, who runs one of the pro 11s. He gets his knickers in a twist with a guy called Burrup, who's the president of Surrey Cricket Club. And those two, they get into some personal dispute, which can't really work out. And that's why you have the North-South divide in cricket in England. Like, it comes out of this one little fight. And then, you know, 100 years later, people are writing how they're just fundamentally culturally different people. And it's like yeah, there is a bit of that. But it all traces back to the fact that you know, these guys didn't get along. One of them was a professional, the other was the president of Surrey. So even the pro-am divide kind of comes out of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Anyway, it's a story for a podcast in about a year, I guess. So look forward to that. Anything else? All right, so we'll jump back to Cow Corner. All right. Actually, that was the end of the C.I. Thornton's 11. So let's jump over and have a look at the card. So 8th, 9th, 10th of September. We've got a good old three-day match here. Thornton win the toss and send Australia in.
Which tells you everything about the state of the pitch or the weather that they've decided not to bat first, and it's reflected, I suspect, in the scorecard, the stray being bowled out.
Yes, it was very, very wet that first morning. Yep. So that is about the worst scorecard. So Australia all out for 81. And yeah, 4, 7, 0, 12, 2, 12, 18, 7, 5, 5, 4. And Hitch doing all the damage. 6 for 24 off his 12 overs. And then, Russ, what are the English doing in return?
Well, they made 187, so it wasn't the largest total, but Hobbs is opening with Knight. They've put on 28, and there's a little bit of a collapse. They're 4 for 49, but they managed to get enough runs down that bottom of the order with Rhodes, Hurst, and Stevens all getting in the 20s, and Spooner, 47 above that, to at least make a big lead
Yeah, it's that sort of that 5 for 89 through to 6 for 143 partnership that sort of did it all, and there's collapses on either side of that. So, yeah, 106 behind. The Australians come out again. All the while, the wicket has been drying up. Yeah, and it's Gregory doing most of the damage for the Australians. 7 for 83 off 29 overs, with Collins picking up a handy couple as well. And, yeah, Gregory 1, 2, 3 bowled and an LBW in that, so beating him for pace.
Yeah, and at the end of the first day, 8 for 146. So the second innings essentially started on the second day. Australia being bowled out essentially before lunch.
Yeah, 30 overs, yeah.
So Australia's second innings is starting with a drier pitch, a whole overnight chance to start. They've done better, but they haven't done well enough probably to set a large target when you start 106 runs behind.
Yeah, but then you end up with a, you know, 1 for 2. So Trenery comes in and he's been ducked out almost first ball, I'd say. I don't have that exact number, but I'd say that's almost first ball, 1 for 2. But then, yeah, Collins and Willis come to the rescue and get Australia through. Willis misses out on his century by 4 runs. And then also Taylor coming in at number 6, getting his 71. So Australia ends up 296. So that's more runs than was scored on the first day in 2 innings. So that's really... It's hard, as modern watchers of the game, it's hard to appreciate just how much the wet wicket mattered. Like, I've been kicking around. I wouldn't mind making a little YouTube series or something where I get people to play cricket on wet wickets.
And, I've done that many times.
And just to,
not that much fun.
just to see people who can actually, like, spin the ball, just seeing what they can do with those, you know, especially that crusty top you get when you've been out in the, when it's had a big baking sun after drying up, because, yeah. And the other one, underarm. I want to see underarm bowling. I've actually been thinking, I'm going to start practicing my underarm bowling, and so that can be my party trick, to be able to properly underarm bowl. Because hearing all the stuff, as like I said, I've been reading all this mid-19th century stuff, and it's between sort of the 40s and the 60s where you go from underarm to overarm. And I don't know, they had these, like the shooter, that was a really common one. So from what I can tell, it must have been, so I think it's the flipper is the spin bowling when you pinch it out of your fingers. And so it must have been something like that, where, so you're coming through the underarm and you pinch it and it shoots out, and it had some sort of top spin on it or something. So it really bounced on. And, yeah, and then twist, because you didn't have spin bowlers, you had twist bowlers. You twisted the ball. And, hearing them talk about, they must have got some considerable spin off their underarm, because definitely by the 70s and the 80s, when most people are bowling overarm, you're still at that point hearing people saying, well, you don't get as much twist overarm. So the underarm was, you know, and that's why it sort of hung around while the overarm was able to get going, because they could just get all that spin off it. I'd love to see some proper, because it's hard to tell when you're reading text what's going on, because there's not any really good descriptions of it. There might be in some of those cricketing guides like Lily White's or Boxers and stuff like that. So I might have a look at some of them. But yeah, I'd love to see a good underarm bowling, like done properly. It'd be, on some sticky wickets. So, coming out onto this much better day 2 wicket, probably would have had a roll in the morning. This is, you know, we are rolling in the mornings at this stage. And between innings as well, you'll get a roll a lot of the time. So they've come out 296. So, you know, now they're setting 190 to win, I think it is.
Yeah, essentially on a third day pitch, it would have flattened out over the period of time.
Yeah. Yeah, well, this is the thing. It's that the third day pitch was probably much, much, much better than the first day pitch.
Yes.
You know, well, it's counterintuitive to us moderns with our covered wickets.
And Hitch has taken 5 for 102, but all of his wickets were down the bottom of the order. So he's come in having not taken early wickets and rolled through the tail.
And bowled, done and most order. Of the bowl. Yeah, bowled a third of the overs. So, yeah. Mm. Yeah, and it all down. It is all down. So it's Rhodes and Douglas and Hurst and Falcon up the top. No answer to the early Australian innings, and then chasing 191 to win, and JB Hobbs, he comes out with Knight. Knight's bowled by Gregory early on. It's 1 for 5, but. Not a lot of, you know, a bit shaky there from Thornton's 11, but Hobbs, with his 93, able to sort of see them through for quite some time. Most of the innings, I'd say, he was out there.
This became pretty exciting, this game, actually, at the tail end of the match, because England were 4 for 141. They need 50 to win. It's relatively straightforward. There's a couple of wickets. Gregory's got a couple of wickets. Collins has picked up a wicket. Hobbs has obviously got out towards the tail end. Suddenly they were 8 for 181. They still need 10. There's 2 wickets left. They've lost 2 for 1.
Yep.
You could see in the scorecard the tension that would have suddenly arisen within that last few overs while they got those last 10 runs.
Yeah, and so it's just close of day 2, Australia, so 6 for 146. So Australia's come out, scored another 50, and then they've gone in and what we got there, 36, 70 overs. So I would imagine they were almost out of time too. So this would have been a proper thriller. Yeah, 2 wickets, probably only 30 minutes, and a handful of runs.
And late mid-September, so the lights maybe not that great at this time of year potentially, particularly if it'd been overcast and so forth. So you might have been fading light, poor visibility. Gregory bowling quick.
Yeah, that's it would have been quite the exciting one. Oh, here you go. Yeah, so George Hurst passed 35,500 first class runs when he reached 8 in this. So just an idea of the mountain that George Hurst was. So that's C.I. Thornton's 11. The trial match of whether or not international cricket is a good idea. Absolute thriller. Packed house. I'd say we've got our answer. Cricket's back. And that's the last real game. We've got one more to go to, and that's over to Mitcham. I believe actually it's Lacey's 11, this one. I think it's known as. Sorry?
16.
Yeah, Mitcham 16. Yep. Yeah, so this is one of the... They play a 12, so the first game's a 12-a-side, but they've all been even sides. Oh, no, they played some against the odds up in Scotland as well. So, yeah, so this is how you do it. Very common.
It's a real knockabout at the end of a tour. But actually, one thing I wanted to ask is, do you sense that they were kind of getting tired of the cricket? Because to me, they played 3-4 months of this. And at first, obviously, oh, great, we're playing cricket again. We've been at war for 4 years. Surely at some point these players are like, I really want to go home.
Well, so if they had not joined the team and just waited their turn to go home, like they probably would have only left 6 weeks earlier. So they haven't actually, it's not like they would have been like, oh, we could have been home by now. They wouldn't have been. Most Australians don't get back until the end of 1919, early 1920. So there is that. It is not a story. It's not a theme that comes up a lot about them being sick and tired of it. It comes up a lot that, you know, they're doing a lot, that it is quite a stressful tour, but there doesn't seem to be a getting sick of it kind of feeling to it. Although it is noticeable that the second trip to Scotland is pretty much just a holiday. They play like 3 one-day games that week against, you know, hack sides and, you know, score like 750 runs in an innings and that kind of thing.
Because early on, they were playing every day pretty much.
Every day, yeah, for most of it. But the last maybe month of the tour, it does seem to start spacing out a bit. And I don't know whether that's just... I think it... Because it's not just a scheduling thing, because a lot of the schedule's done first, but then you do just pick up games. That's the way cricket was back then. If you had a spare weekend, you'd be... You read the papers at the time, and there's always like, you know, some Frog's bottom 11 seeks to play anyone in the area kind of thing. You're writing and looking for people to play against. So, yeah, so they probably could have picked up more, but there really is a sense by the end of it that
maybe some of the novelty's worn off in terms of picking up matches as well.
Yeah. Well, it's not even the novelty. They're definitely. It's not that they're getting tired, but you can see by the end of it that it's not trying to. It's not just all the time. There really is a little bit, sort of more entertainment going on, a little bit more focus on social side of things and
big
stuff.
Matches, which they played at the this tail.
Yeah, it's all the festivals at the end. So yeah, so, and then the reason they go out to. To Mitcham is because Howard Lacey is I think he's the president of Mitcham. He's the guy who managed the AIF 11 for most of the tour. He doesn't go with them to Scotland the second time, and Ernie Cameron takes over then. And Ernie Cameron's effectively the manager for the rest of the tour. He takes them to South Australia and Australia. So Lacey, this is kind of like Lacey's send off to them. So this is a one-day game against a 16. Ernie Cameron and Sterling are both playing for the 16, and it's so this is not a serious game. This is hit and giggle, say goodbye to your mates kind of thing. And then in the Australian side, there's a C Smith and a WJ Munday, and I have no idea who these two guys are. They only have one record on Cricket Archive, which is this game, and there's no contemporary Mondays or Smiths playing in Shield cricket before or after the war around that time. I haven't been able to find, like, WJ Munday, I thought I'd be able to find something at the war archives, wasn't able to find anything there. And Smith, you don't find C. Smith. And if you don't have any other details, you do not find that person. That's impossible. There'll be 40 C. Smiths. So, I don't know who these guys were, but two guys who have not played any other cricket with them have jumped in to play this game. I think maybe they played for the headquarters team a bit. So I think they were Australian soldiers who'd been playing for the Wattles, as they were known, which is like the second 11. But yeah, it sort of indicates the seriousness of the game. If you have looked up on Wikipedia about the AIF 11, this is the game that has the poster for, and the poster just is all kinds of wrong. So many of the names are wrong. A bunch of the people on the poster are not going to come up. They were never going to be there. But what we might do is we might jump over and just read Cal Corner's telling of this game. And then I'll explain it before I go and read it, because... As I've explained many times, the way these diaries are created is by taking snippets from other sources, mostly newspapers, but sometimes war diaries or war records and that kind of thing, and stitching them together in this bricolage technique. I have been able to find one report of this game, and it's one sentence long. So I'll read you Cow Corner. Our final contest of the tour was a one-day match against an invitational 16 of Mitcham, captained by Howard Lacey, the man charged with the original management of the AIF 11. 17 fours, a fielder's eye badly damaged, and a smash screen of a motor car standing in the roadway adjoining the cricket green were the chief features of a dashing batting display by Gregory, as he made a 134-run partnership with C. Smith, who, along with WJ Munday, the South Australian colt, joined us for the match. Sorry, yes, I did find out, yes, that Munday had played, he was a South Australian, and he had played some Colts matches for SA, but that's all I was able to sort of find out about him. So the sentence here, 17 fours, a fielder's eye badly damaged, and a smash screen of a motor car standing in the roadway adjoining the cricket green were the chief features of a dashing batting display by Gregory. That is 100% of the contemporary words I can find written about this game. So that is it. So the Mitchum guys out there, they might have some stuff in their own archives. If you've got any more details on that game, any more eyewitness reports or anything, I'd love to see them. So let me know. One more line from Cow Corner, and so ends the Northern Hemisphere portion of the tour. We have one more engagement, a farewell dinner at Cafe Monaco, and then it is on to South Africa. So we'll jump over C.I. Thornton's 11, no, Mitchum, 16 of Mitchum. So they toss not known, because I imagine there probably wasn't one. They probably just went, you guys go and have a bat. But it's Collins, the chief destructor, taking 7 of the 16. Trennery picks up a fifer as well. So you know, not the most productive bowler on the tour, but yeah, Trennery's had a good one there. No scores really worth a note until you... Oh, actually, Howard Lacey down there batting at 15, put on... he got himself 39 runs. So what's that last... I reckon this is not in the right order, this scorecard. Because how do you...
It would seem unlikely that he scored 39 runs out of a 24-run partnership if he came in at 15.
And yeah.
14th.
Yeah. And it does seem unlikely that there is that the not out is the third last guy on one not out, and then the guy who came in after him got 39. That seems unlikely.
It's some solid bannerman.
Yeah. So I mean, that's just reading the scorecard, but at the same time, there is a very good chance that Lacey got some pies chucked up at him, so he could just whack him. He was there, mate. So, and it was an unserious game, so there is a chance of that, but.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting because the bowling card implies that Gregory and Collins didn't open the bowling. They came in later and Collins just wiped out the lower order at a certain time. But maybe that wasn't the case. Maybe the scorecard didn't properly reflect the who bowled when.
Yeah, so I reckon that could be a sketchy scorecard. So Mitchum guys, if you've got a scorecard from it, it might be worth you having a compare of what you've got with what's on Cricket Archive, and you may be able to help make Cricket Archive a little bit better there. So all out for 200, their 16 wickets fell. The Australians came in to reply. Oh, this is an interesting score. So the Australians end up 5 for 207. I wonder what that last, maybe scorer was asleep.
wouldn't be the first time that someone scored significantly more than they need, or maybe they just let them bat on. It's interesting that there's only 6 players with a score, so at some point they haven't actually listed who came to the wicket or didn't score any runs if they did come.
Yeah.
Both Smith and Munday actually batted.
So you've got 6 with a score, but 5 out.
5 out.
And so there's 5-4, so that's, so someone went out for that 207. And they went, oh, I guess
that'll do.
Check the score.
Oh, we've passed them. We should stop.
There you go. Smith's gone out. Check the score. So Smith's made 61. So considering you've got no idea who he is, that's, like I said, 140-odd run partnership with Gregory. So they were 3 for 18, chasing the 200 of the 16. And then Gregory and Smith... batted the game away, and then Taylor came in with a cheeky 33 at the end to get them over the line, plus a few. Sterling taking 2 wickets. So who's that Smith? Is there a Smith in the... H. Smith. Interesting. Okay. Maybe C. Smith could be a relative. Who knows? Who knows? I don't know who these Smiths are. It's a ridiculous name. It really is. I do like that Steve Smith is Stephen Peter Devereaux Smith, because there's not a lot of Devereaux's around, so at least you can call him Stephen Devereaux and you don't have to worry about the... Because he's not the first Steve Smith to play cricket for Australia even, so it's a bit confusing.
It was notable with on that poster that was very wrong, but C. Smith was named as one of the the players. So whoever he was well enough known to have been listed as someone should potentially go to see, unless they actually printed it on the day.
Yeah, well, who's the... I'm just having a look at this poster. I'm going to try and see if I can get any details out of... Oh, that's not what I wanted to do. Try and see if we can get any details out the bottom. Might be able to see who printed. The Mitcham Printing Works. It's the Parade, London Road in Mitcham. It was locally printed, but I imagine it's Harry Histed's benefit. No idea who that is. Maybe one of the Mitcham people can tweet at us. But yeah, H. Smith is on the Australian side as well, and C. Smith. S. Pierce, that's interesting. I wonder if that is Senator Pierce, and Senator Pierce was going to be there, because he was, like, Senator Pierce is the Australian Foreign Minister. Mm-hmm. And he is definitely connected to the team, because it's... that's how... So A. Bailey, who's this super wealthy South African, negotiates with Pierce to get the Australians to go to South Africa. So he definitely was around and part of the team. So it's interesting that he's on there.
It gives the impression of some of the people who'd been involved in the tour as an administrative capacity or in organising had said, oh, yeah, I'll come to this match. And I wouldn't mind a play, because I fancy myself as a bit of a cricketer. And yeah. Some of them have ended up playing for Mitcham, and some of them have ended up playing for Australia. And
yeah, well, like Ernie Cameron and Howard Lacey, they're the two managers of the side. So, yeah.
Very unserious match, though.
A very, very unserious match, yeah. This is the kind of match where you'd expect the umpire to have an esky where you could buy beers from. That's the peak level of cricket for me. Yeah, if you can't buy beers off the umpire, the game's too serious.
So, yes, or the opposition's at square leg doing the umpiring and holding a bat to show that they're not a player.
Speaking of buying beers off the umpire, I was reading some of the early intercolonial matches. No, it's the very first English tour when they're playing Victoria. And the Victorians just kept leaving the field and going to the bar. Like, during the match. They were like, you know, if you guys were interested in playing cricket and not drinking, we might be able to have a game of cricket here. So it's, but we're going to talk about boozy lunches in the next episode. So I'll save some of that for then. I think that's all we have to talk about from that game. The Australians won by 7 runs somehow. I've got some notes down here. So B.W. Bullock, who we haven't spoken about, but he's on the other side. He owns the pub opposite, was mine host at the public house. I don't know what a mine host is, that now bears his name. So I'm guessing that the Mitcham folks know who B.W. Bullock is. And this has come from WAG's score sheet. Interesting that we've got those notes on it. So there. All right, I think that might do us for this week, actually, and we will leave it there. Russ, thanks for joining me once again.
Thank you.
And we will see you next week, where we will discuss the last days of the Australians in England as they leave for South Africa. I've been Anthony Condon. Tweet me at Ant Condon. Email me anthony@anthonycondon.com. And if the folks from the Mitcham have listened to this, I hope you had a wonderful anniversary that you're planning out there. And thanks for listening, everyone else. We will see you next week. Goodbye. DNA. So when they start to play and you want to know and you can't find the call on the radio, call the White Line Wireless. White Line Wireless. White Line Wireless. White Line Wireless. Just one click to hear it all. Boba, boba, bloody bo. The main of every true blue fan is the Bidex cricketer anchor man. It's the same old words in the same old voice. Blood.
Bloody Bowl.